Kathy Munoz, chairing the committee, the Education Committee this morning. It is 8 a.m. and joined with me here is Representative Wilson of Wrangell. We will be joined by additional committee members, and I will introduce them as they arrive. I wanted to start on time today. We have a full agenda, several presenters, and just 2 hours to get all of the information in. So before we continue, Representative Book has joined us, and Representative Gardner. Thank you. And also Representative Edgman. Hello. I should have waited a few minutes.
Nope. We should get here earlier.
I was going with watch.
And Representative Keller, thank you for joining today. We have a full agenda, so I wanted to start right on time at 8 a.m. Chair Seaton is away on a trip celebrating his father's 100th birthday, so we want to, again, wish him well with his family and look forward to his return next week. First of all, on the agenda, we have a report from the Galena Interior Academy, and joining us online is Principal Harry White. Mr. White, are you online?
Yes, this is Harry White.
Okay, I would like to go ahead and turn the program over to you, and we've allocated about 10 minutes for the presentation and an additional 10 minutes for questions. So go right ahead, please.
Okay, first off, this is Harry White, principal of Galena Interior Learning Academy. I've been here 6 years, been around Alaska for at least 12 as administrator. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to share things about our school with the House Education Committee. Your time is valuable, and I'll try to be brief. Please feel free to ask questions at any time. Galena Interior Learning Academy started in 1997. This is its 12th year. Since then, we've graduated 159 students, and we presently have 114 students. We tried to get to 150 this year, but we don't advertise, which we're going to change this year. And we've only received students by word of mouth up to this point. But with the BRAC process and a number of buildings we have here in Galena, we've decided that we should have more students. Our great successes is since the qualifying exam has been put in, we've only had one student not pass it by the time they graduated, and they did pass it the next year. So we've got 100% success on all of our graduates having passed the qualifying exam. Our vocational offerings is part of our highlights. We put in a new health strand. It's a career strand. In that health strand, we have two different college classes that we offer college credit for. And so it's a tech prep agreement. The expenses are paid for by the tech prep program. That was allied health and medical terminology. This moves us into the medical field. And we've offered two different CNA courses to adults. Over 20 students have graduated out of that program, many of which are working. I guess I should back up. Our program is, by the time a student is a sophomore, they get into introductory vocational classes. By the time they're a junior, they're at least a quarter time, if not a half time, in those classes. If they complete, by the time they graduate, they can become certified. If not, they can come back at 13th and 14th year and finish off those programs. Cosmetology is a perfect example of that. A student can enroll as a sophomore year, half-time as a junior, and half-time as a senior. They have to finish 1,650 hours by state and federal guidelines to become cosmetology certified, pass a written and practical test. We've had one student do that upon graduation. The rest of them usually come back 1 or 2 years. Our instructor in cosmetology has been here 34 years. He comes to us from Seward about 6 years ago. Right now, we have 36 enrolled in cosmetology and 3 adults who are finishing off from previous years. We also have an adult who is under training to become an instructor as our program. We bought enough equipment to be twice the size we are. We right now have 6 chairs. We have enough space for 12 chairs. We're hoping to get money to remodel a larger facility here to be able to fit those students. Right now we're hampered by the size of our facility. More students want in. We've had 16 graduates from cosmetology. 13 are working in the industry, and that includes Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and other places. Two are raising families at home, and one's working out of the profession, so pretty good success there. Another one of our vocational programs is aviation. If a student enrolls in our program, all expenses are paid with the exception of their test fee. Right now, we've had 8 private pilots complete our program and in the last 5 years, and 2 have completed instrument pilot programs. Those 2 that have completed instrument are going to school in Fairbanks and working for Everett's Air, so 100% success ratio there. One of our private pilots is teaching ground school at Elmendorf Air Force Base, which I think is a great success. In our aviation program right now, we offer all-day instruction as well as a night class for adults. One of our periods during the day is also on the Internet through eLive to our correspondence program, which is part of our district as well. That's offered to about 800 high school students, 700 or 800. We have to limit the enrollment to 10, which it has 9 in it right now. One of our other vocational programs is culinary arts. We've had several trainings there. Our greatest success has been with the safety and sanitation health certificates. We've had 8 complete that, and every restaurant is supposed to have somebody with that certificate. Most of our students are using that as they're going through other post-secondary instruction. It's a way to make some money to move forward. Next year, we're implementing ProStart. It's a program by National Restaurant Association. And in 2 years, a student then can finish that and can work in any restaurant in the nation. Our 5th vocational program is automotive. Our automotive instructor has all 8 possible ASC certifications that you can get. We're working toward the NATIF certification, which is the National Automotive Technology Education Foundation. And then our students will be able to get jobs actually working in any mechanic shop anywhere. We have 3 students that have 5 adults who have completed that program and are in one part or another of the ASC certification, brakes, power plant, fluids, or something. We're working towards, one of the things we're working with a lot is we're working with Mount Edgecombe, Bill Hutton, so that we're not all working for the same students. We're trying to offer as much as we can to the students of Alaska since we are a school of choice. What we've realized is that I've heard just this last week there were 500 students in our urban areas. Our high school students are homeless and not going to school. We hope to attract more of those students. And I also heard this week, as a sideline, it costs $44,000 to incarcerate a prisoner. I think educating those students is a better way to go. Some of them might wind up in incarceration. We're also offering driver's education. Through the AGEA process, we've realized we need CDL drivers, but many of our rural folks don't have a driver's license. So we're offering driver's education. We've graduated 15 out of that last semester and have another 15 in this semester, with CDL classes being planned for this spring. Line service technician is another class we have offered twice. We have 18 completers. In order to load fuel or anything, any airplane anywhere, you're supposed to have a line service technician certificate. And we've had students working in that capacity. Hospitality with Princess Lines, we've had that program twice. We have students working in Denali Park, different motels in Fairbanks. Again, most of those students are working to go on to post-secondary education. This year, we've completed 3 programs, plumbing, carpentry, and electricity through Alaska Works Partnership for adults only. And they've had 10 of them each. Right now, financially, a question you may ask is, what does it cost us to educate a student here? It's between $26,000 and $30,000. And that's a variable number because if we have 150 students, it's going to cost less per student than if we have 100 students. So that's why that's a variable number. Our expenses stay the same, whether all the beds are full or not. May I answer any questions at this time?
Thank you, Mr. White. We will open it up for questions. Yes, Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. I've been out to your facility. It's a beautiful lot of good buildings and everything. Would you describe the connect between the boarding school and the career training that you do, and as you describe those, I've had a tour of every one of your the categories, and it's very, very impressive. And you got engaged teachers, and you've got engaged community, and students, and I was really impressed. But If you would, describe the connection between the boarding school and the career training, please.
Okay, the boarding school, with our vocational programs, we require 4 English, 4 Math, 4 Science, and 4 Social Studies to graduate. I believe we require more academic credits than any school in the state. But with that, in order to use a carrot to get students to come here, we offer those career pathways. And they can start those as a junior and typically don't finish before they get out of high school. So that keeps them in school and sends them away with a certificate or a license where they can work. Often, so they come back their 13th and 14th year and work, and that also attracts the 13th and 14th year, attracts adults from other areas to come in there and work. So that career pathway, and I hope I've answered your question, that those career pathways keep the students in school, and when they leave our school, they go to work. So that's a good opportunity. We also offer those classes to students at the other school, the community school, and some of them come over and take those as well. Did I answer your question, Representative Keller?
You did. Thank you. And I just want to say thank you for the innovation and the hard work out there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keller. Are there Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Harry, you mentioned that you had 2 different medical programs. One was CNA, and what was the other one?
Well, actually, we're shooting towards 1 career medical program because we certainly know that's necessary in Alaska. We have 2 classes in high school where students can get high school credit and college credit through a tech prep program, and that is allied health classes and medical terminology classes. Those are the initial classes you're going to need for any medical training, and we've offered CNA twice, certified nursing assistant twice, to adults. We're hoping to eventually foster our own students to be moving into those health programs instead of pulling adults from other places, even though we'll keep doing that. So it's kind of all tied together, Peggy.
Okay, thank you. And one follow-up. I was writing down, and I missed. You require 4 English, 4 Math, and 4 what else?
4 English, 4 Math, 4 Science, and 4 Social Studies to graduate. We require 26 credits to graduate. Those vocational programs wind up being their electives.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Further questions, Representative Wilson?
No, that'll be
no. Representative Gardner, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. White. I'm very interested in your program and other such around the state, boarding schools, that is. I may be the only person in this room that actually went to a boarding school, and I went to a boarding school for 3 years, so I have a little understanding about what it's like from the student perspective. And as we on this education committee ponder the high school graduation rates and approaches we might take to improve this state's numbers, one of the things that I'm curious about is if you see any distinct kind of qualities that your students have, qualities or assets that may help them to see the opportunity that you offer and take advantage of it compared to students who maybe never do that. Do you think that's simply a matter of advertising, or is there something else that's unique about your population?
Thank you. Yes, I think one of the things that's unique about our population is that we try to have a family-type atmosphere. The resiliency grants that we get, we try to provide, when we bring a student in, we regulate everything. And of course, as high school students, they don't want to be regulated, as all of us didn't want to be. And so we have specific bedtimes, we have wake times, we provide the 3 meals a day, but we also provide lots of activities. We encourage our staff and community members to check the students out in the evenings for dinner, have them go around. We have snow machine clubs. We have all sorts of things to keep the students involved. And I think that's why our students come here and for the most part stay. Is because it's not just school 7.5 hours a day. Adding to that, we have tutors. We have after-school tutors. To any student who's having a hard time, we pay our certified teachers to stay after school and tutor. And we offer 480 minutes of school a day, where the state standard, I believe, is 300. So we offer that. Simple things like when we do a detention or suspension, it's not during the school day, it's at night or on weekends. They're here anyway. my takeaway from their school day. So things like that. I think it's more of a family atmosphere, knowing all the students on a first-name basis, and unfortunately, when we get to 300, that probably won't be as possible. But we stay in contact with their parents. Our grading system allows parents to get on the online and get their students' grades at any time of day or night, and things like that. Did I answer your question, Representative Gardner?
I think so. Thank you. I guess what I'm curious about is sometimes we can have the same population, and I'm really interested in this statewide, and some people, I mean, we could say all of our kids have opportunity, but not everybody can see it and recognize that it's there and somehow be inspired to take advantage of it. And I think particularly for a young person from a very small community who hasn't ever left, it's a real challenge to imagine themselves leaving and going and living away from their family and everybody they know and doing something different. And we know that that's one of the benefits that the Scholars Program has brought us, that kids all across Alaska now know at least one person who's gone to the university, and it sort of plants the seed that, yes, I could do that too, where they may it may never have occurred to them to ever think of that before. And, you know, ANSEP, the engineering program at UAA, works really hard to retain those kids, and I think it's part of the reason for their success that they're planting seeds around the state. So I think you're doing the same thing, and the trick, I guess, is to make sure that kids everywhere know about it, and then when you have maximized what you think can be done at your facility, to maybe replicate it in other areas of the state. Thank you.
I think our largest challenge is to get that word out there. We've gone by word of mouth in the past. This year we're going to start advertising. Seems like everywhere we go, people say, we've never heard of your school. So I think I totally agree with you, just getting the word out there. And then, of course, the challenge of keeping the students once they come. But we're hoping that our new advertising lets them know exactly what we are and exactly what we offer so that when they come here, it's exactly what they expected.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, one follow-up, please. Go ahead.
It's another issue, and I can wait till somebody else.
Oh, no, go right ahead.
Okay. I've been sort of thinking about boarding schools around the state, and one of the downsides, I mean, if we are successful in motivating kids to seize the opportunity and do it, what's the impact on the home schools of those communities when the most motivated kids are gone and the natural leadership has left and may or may not ever go back to that little community? And one of the things that might work, and I'd be interested to know what you'd think about this, is instead of having a year-round boarding school, have like intensives where kids would go, say, to your facility for 1 month. They're still enrolled in their home school, but they can go to your facility and do an intensive program for VOTEC and then follow up maybe every year to do just focus on one specific element for a short period and then go back to their home schools. And I know in Anchorage some of the alternative schools and some of the colleges are in the country do the same thing where they have like an interim session that just is one class all day every day.
Well, to address that, Representative Gardner, is our first question would be funding. Of course, there's no funding as far as I know for that kind of program, but maybe there's something I don't know about. But and funding is, of course, our concern anyway. We do summer programs 1 month at a time, 3 weeks at a time. We have three different programs we offer in the summer that is just for that, because we certainly don't want our school to negatively affect any village school or small school. In fact, I believe new legislation has been put in to assist with that. We don't necessarily get the strongest leaders and the highest academic students from the small village. We don't look at grades in any capacity to accept a student. If they fail most of their classes, doesn't matter. We feel with our hands-on policy and our close touch with the students policy, after-school tutor program and things like that, we really do raise a lot of students that are come to us with very poor grades and wind up being very successful. So we do get some of their better students, but we also get some of the students that simply don't work out in the village school or community school. But we certainly don't want to negatively affect them. And your thoughts there are certainly well taken. I've written down. Maybe we could do more of that.
Just okay. A quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. I was very careful to say not the brightest or the best students, but those who somehow are motivated to sort of reach out to the opportunity, and that isn't necessarily the smartest kids or the best students.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Harry, this is a real softball question, but I think it'd be good to get it on the record. Do you have room for expansion out there, facility-wise?
Actually, I hope you all, Representative Keller, I hope you've all received the packet that I sent to Marcy Hansen, or Herman. It's got a picture of our facilities, the first two or three pages. The front page is a map, and almost everything on that picture is our school. We have huge amount of rooms for expansion. Our challenge is most of those buildings were designed for military, and they need to be remodeled. And, of course, we don't have the money to remodel them unless we make the CIP list. For example, we've got two dorms. One will hold 300 students, and the other one will hold about 150. One with 150 is where we're putting our adults because we don't house adults and students together. And we're hoping to remodel part of that to increase our cosmetology program, but it got taken off the CIP list. So we have many buildings that we've turned into cold storage because we don't have the money to remodel. So thank you for bringing that up. We have huge areas for expansion when we can find the finances to do that. We could accept 300 students now.
Thank you.
Would you like a follow-up? That's good. Okay. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is similar, and I was looking at the aerial picture as well and looking at the number of facilities. It's a tremendous amount of facilities, and I guess my specific question was about operating expenses, knowing that in the narrative it says that the Air Force has officially turned over many buildings to the school district and so forth. But when the transfer does become complete, I'm assuming that just to keep the buildings heated and the lights on and so forth, that's going to be quite an expense. But where does that leave you in terms of the future?
Thank you, Representative Edsman. The transfer has been complete. The Air Force is gone. Where that leaves us right now is paying all of the expenses. Our utilities are quite large. I'm thinking ranging over $100,000 a month. So the expenses are quite large, and it was designed to keep a facility going for quite a few military people. And so without greater numbers of students and greater amounts of support, it's difficult to keep open, yes, because we've had to cold storage many of those buildings. So a good question, and that is one of our struggles right now for sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there additional questions for Mr. White? Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today. It was a very good presentation, very informative, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you, and thanks for your...
Thank you. As a segue, we also have a program presentation on the Mount Edgecombe School, and Superintendent Bill Hutton has joined us on the phone. Mr. Hutton, are you there?
I am here. Okay. You all hear me?
Okay, great. We have approximately 10 to 15 minutes for your presentation, and then we'll follow with questions.
Fantastic. I will obey the guidelines, but it's going to be difficult. I would like to actually feed off of what I've heard. One thing, Representative Gardner, there is a really fascinating publication, 30 Years Later, The Long-Term Effect of Boarding Schools on Alaska Natives and Their Communities, by Diane Hirschberg and Suzanne Sharp, which is from the Institute of Social and Economic Research. It's on the web, and it's very interesting. Secondly, Mr. White has an outstanding program, along with Mr. Smith as superintendent, and I would like to feed off that, too. We've been working together and we believe that we're in the business of providing an array of educational opportunities for all of Alaska teenagers that wish to participate, and it's exciting to work along with them. Mount Edgecombe started as a federal school in 1947, closed as a federal school in 1982, and reopened as a state school in 1985. Right now, we have 378 students representing over 100 Alaska communities. We have 348 students in the dorm, the most ever since the late 50s. We do have student attrition. 23 students went home in the fall, It's 20% fewer than the fall of 07, and we're pretty pleased about that. 11 reported homesickness as a reason to leave. 6 reported that the parent requested them to come home for a variety of reasons. 3 were due to family emergencies, and 3 we sent home due to various things that resulted in not being able to safely live in a dorm with other students. We did have 27 students that did not return in January from the first semester, which is a 25% decrease from the previous year, but it's still more students than we would prefer to have more, even more return. Just as far as admissions go, we do go through a number of applications, but only about 35 applicants were not accepted in August of 2008 for the school year. Why do students come here? 81% of alumni respondents state, quote, the higher quality of education as the reason they come to Mount Edgecombe. I'll give you some examples. The genetics program, which is a class that offers genetic techniques to discover local ecological impacts through DNA sequencing, and results in 4 University of Alaska credits for the students. They actually look at DNA sequence, they've added to the gene bank. Actually, 2 of our students went to the International Science Fair in Atlanta, Georgia last year and placed 2nd in their division, which is really exciting for us. Another example is the oceanography class, and the kids work directly with Scripps Institute, a couple people there, to analyze hydrophone recordings in the Arctic Ocean. There's a hydrophone, and they have a year's worth of recordings, and our students are going through the massive amounts of data, and they look for whale and other sounds, and they're excited about it. We offer trigonometry, calculus, advanced chemistry, physics, Chinese and Japanese languages and Spanish, Pacific Rim studies, animation, video productions, among many other classes. It's interesting, too, in the academic world, I think it was Representative Gardner that mentioned ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Project. 17 students are actually signed up with them to pursue either engineering or science in college or university. But this year we have 70 students that are going to do the computer build. And what happens is ANSEP brings computer parts down, and 70 of our kids are going to build their own computer. The deal is with ANSEP is once you build your own computer, you can keep it as long as you take and pass trigonometry and chemistry in before you graduate from college. But that's amazing to me to have 70 students. 56% of our students start college. After 5 years, 29% of those graduate from college. That is not a totally comprehensive. It is the ICER Institute of Social and Economic Research, and associated with the University of Alaska Anchorage, did a study which was a Mount Edgecombe High School alumni survey by Diane Hirschberg and Britt Del Moral, and that this data is from that survey. We also have very good career technical programs. Our most successful program is welding. We have 6 students that graduated in the last 3 years that are employed and at various places around Alaska making between $60,000 and $85,000. We have a residential construction program. We have a certified nursing assistant program, certification program, where the students actually result in getting CNA certification. We have emergency trauma training, where quite a number of kids take and pass ETT, a young first responder, where they actually go on call. Small engines. Another of our challenges, probably more than the Gila School, is driver's licenses. I got about 300 students who want either permits or licenses. As most of us know, driver's licenses are a barrier if you do not have one, particularly in unions, joining a union or getting a job. And the state is very nervous about a student using a car to practice driving. So we got a liaison with the University of Alaska for that, but when it comes down to the drivers, they're going to have to use my personal car. A little scary. residential life is demanding and exciting. The students have to maintain their own clean rooms and their clean areas. They have detail. The other thing is that really there's not a lot of free time, but students, if they are not performing well and as well as they should in class, there's a mandatory tutorial, which is for right after school, 4 to 5. Then there's a mandatory study time from 7 to 8:30 for every student. They have to squeeze meal. They have to do meals in there. They have to do their own laundry. But there's still plenty of things for them to do. They have a dance every 2 weeks. They have kayaking, paintball, open gym, rock climbing, ropes course, multiple cultural programs. There's a variety of leadership options here for students to be able to participate. But really what they come for is just exciting. It's one of the things that you just do as an adult is when there's a pep rally and you watch 380 kids or 400 kids, depending on the time of the year, all in gym, all packed together, doing 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, yelling competitions and skits, and they're into it, they love it, and they love being together. Life is social, and teenagers are a social time, and they just love being together. They love going to dances because there's more people to participate than your cousin or your relatives. There is also a huge tradition, I'm sure you know, of Mount Edgecombe. There's I vision as a loosely woven fabric that fits over top of Alaska. Everybody knows everybody, and they have a huge alumni communication among alumni. We do have some challenges. We have in our dorms are packed. We have to get a waiver from child licensing every year because we have rooms with 5 and 6 students in them. Second of all, I'd love to get a music program, and we just don't have the number of teachers that allows that. The other thing is there are 1940s facilities here. All our dorms, gym, everywhere is they've been renovated over the years, but you still have, we deal with that all the time. And even our, quote, new building, the academic building that was completed in 1986, is obviously 20-some years old and needs a new roof and other things like that. I thank you for the opportunity. Mount Edgecombe is an exciting, dynamic place to be. And just to follow up with Representative Gardner, is I think students have to have courage. They have to have a sense of adventure. They do have a connection to Mount Edgecombe, typically, of that fabric, some type of relatives, and the pride that is associated with attending Mount Edgecombe High School. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hutton. That was a very good presentation, and you painted a great picture of all of the programs, and it was very exciting listening to what's going on down there. Do we have questions, Mr. Hutton? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, as you were speaking, because I've been in the schools and talk with the kids and teach a state government class with the kids, I'm always just totally impressed, because in most schools I go to when I teach that class, when I ask questions, maybe one or two will raise their hands, but there, every single one of them raises their hand. So I'm impressed with what you do. But going back to Representative Gardner's question, I really feel with the boarding schools, one thing that helps the kids more than anything else are the parents. Now, when I say that, you are the parents. And I know how you do it in Mount Edgecombe, because you have families within the community to kind of adopt some of the kids also, so that they get into the community and have time for that. But I think that when kids come from all aspects of society, and I really think that there many of them aren't used to having rules. So you have rules, you have control over when they sleep, when they study, when they play, when they eat. But you also have, so they have a routine in their life that they've never had before. And I really think because there's rewards for them to do certain things and you're teaching them responsibilities, those are things, I think, that really make a difference. And I see that in both boarding schools that have talked this morning. And so I think that helps them more than anything else because you're their parents and they're experiencing parental controls that they've probably, many of them, have never had before. And so I think that that is one of the reasons that many of them succeed. I could be wrong.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I've also visited the school, and it brought back a lot of memories for me. And you're absolutely right that this is an age group that naturally wants to sort of cling together and just love it. And I loved my years in boarding school. But my question is, do we have any idea how often kids who leave their homes to go to a school like Mount Edgecombe or the Gila School, how often do they go back home and live full-time in their home communities?
Yes, I do. On page 11 of the Mount Alumni Survey, the question is, did you return to your home community after graduating from high school? And 57% of the respondents said yes. This survey, and I have talked about it with the authors, but to me it's a little bit flawed. They were not, it was voluntary as to who responded. So there were 126 respondents, it says. So that gives you some indication. It also, if I can add a little bit, it says, if yes, when did you return to your home community? 81% said within 1 year, 12% said within 5 years, and 7% said within 10 years. And that's very interesting little statistic, I think, too.
Thank you.
Okay.
Are there additional questions? There are none. Mr. Hutton, thank you very much for joining us today, and we really appreciate the good work that you're doing there, and we will, I'm sure, be in touch with you in the future as you have requests and needs and budgetary needs. You'll, I'm sure, keep us informed. So thank you again very much for joining today.
And thank you for the opportunity. It is a exciting, dynamic place, and I feel pleased to be able to be a part of it.
Great, thank you. The first part of our presentation today has been focused on boarding schools, the state boarding schools. Now we're going to move into a presentation on early childhood programs and Head Start. And here today to present on early childhood is Cynthia Curran. And she is the Director of Teaching and Learning Support in the Department of Education. Excuse me, Ms. Curran, one minute. Can we take a brief at ease, please? We need... Please. Yes.
For the record, my name is Cynthia Curran, and I am the Director for Teaching and Learning Support in the Department of Education and Early Development. As I said before, there are two areas of focus within the department, Head Start grants and early learning programs. The team that works within this area issues grants to Head Start and early Head Start grantees serving Alaskan children. This unit provides technical assistance and resources to grantees in the area of early childhood education, school readiness, health, nutrition, early development, and administration. This unit partners with other systems development initiatives to address specific issues for young children, birth to 5 years, and their families through federally funded Alaska Head Start Collaboration Project. This unit works on increasing early literacy skills, family literacy skills, early learning skills, and parenting skills for all populations in Alaska. We work to increase access to voluntary, affordable, and quality early care and education, and establishing a sustainable early childhood literacy and learning system with accountability for outcomes. On the website, the EED website, the early learning guidelines have been published. You can look under assessment and accountability. This unit works to help disseminate those, provide training for groups that are using the early learning guidelines.
Okay, great. Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, how many Head Start programs? I think I read that there was 100 of them across the state. How many children does that make?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe there's about 3,000 children being served through the Head Start program, and I know that you're going to get a presentation by the Head Start Association here shortly.
Then I won't pursue that then at all.
Are there additional questions? Thank you, Cynthia. Okay, great. Well, we're moving right along. And next. Thank you. Next, we have Abby Hinsley, who is the director of the Best Beginnings program. This is an effort, a statewide effort, to increase early literacy and to prepare kids for kindergarten. And it's a pleasure to see you, Abby, again. Abby and I have worked together on this project through the Humanities Forum, and really happy to see you here in Juneau. And we also have her husband, Willie Hinsley, is here. Thank you. If you could stand, and thank you for joining today. Abby, if you would like to start, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm Abby Hinsley, the Executive Director of Best Beginnings. And thank you so much to the committee for inviting me to come and share, for some of you, an update, and for others of you, I think, more information than you may have heard before about Best Beginnings and about early learning in our state. I'm really pleased to know that there is a committee devoted to education now, and I thank you all for that. I also think that it gives us who are working in the early childhood arena two committees now to provide information to and to stay in touch with. So it's almost like it's twice as many legislators that we get to talk to who will know more about the work that we're doing. So thank you. Best Beginnings' vision really is that all Alaska children begin school ready to succeed. And it's about creating an environment and systems that can help children do this. It might sound simple, but it really isn't. It's quite complicated, as many of you know. We know that too many children are starting school unprepared. And when children start behind, they rarely catch up. You know, we can talk about no child left behind, but we also should talk about having no child start behind. This lack of readiness contributes to low scores on standardized tests, to poor performance on high school graduation rates, or exams, and our high school dropout rates, as you know, are among the highest in the nation. Well, young brains are very busy. And I know that some of you have seen this picture before, but it shows that at birth, the synapses in the a child's brain, you know, there's not much of it, but it increases dramatically in the first 3 years of life. And I'm told that young children have about 10 quadrillion synapses in their brains, and as they grow older, this pruning process takes place so that children then have what they need to do the work that they're doing. But we know that with all this activity, that what parents and other adults do with young children is absolutely critical. All the reading, singing, dancing, helping with motor skills, communication, social and emotional development, all that. Well, economists tell us that investing in the early years is really the very best kind of economic development that any state can make. And Best Beginnings is pursuing solutions to meet these challenges. And we focus our efforts really in three areas: that parents are a child's first and most important teacher, that quality, affordable, and accessible early care and education programs should be available for families wherever they live, whatever families want, and also that early learning should really be a priority for all Alaskans. And these are recommendations from the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn Task Force, which issued those recommendations, 11 of them, in September of 2006. And they are, I just handed to you, or Louie did, thank you, the 2008 report for Best Beginnings, and the recommendations are listed in there as well as other information about what Best Beginnings has been up to. Well, a question that people ask me often is just who is Best Beginnings? And it's a statewide collaboration, really, of a variety of people, individuals, and entities. And it includes some of the state's largest corporations, businesses of all sizes, philanthropic organizations, government agencies, educational institutions, faith-based entities, and individual supporters. And in your packet, there is a listing of the current Early Learning Council members. Susan Anderson is the chair. She's the CEO and president of the Siri Foundation. Well, we know that early learning, as I said, really is everybody's business, and everybody really has a role to play. We know that early learning matters because it impacts success in school, which then, as you know, impacts success in later life. We heard about about corrections issues. Sometimes people say that, you know, that there are the costs of not investing in the early years far outweighs the cost of making that investment. And we know that as we look toward the future, you know, like many in our state, you know, I think about what will happen as we grow older. You recognize my husband in the audience here. Many of you know that he recently retired. And, you know, as we think about the future, we want to make sure that if we're in the pioneer's home, that there's somebody working out there at good jobs, so we're going to keep the lights on and the you know, doctors coming there and all that kind of thing, so that really this is, it can be for many of us, a personal investment in the future. Well, there are three areas of focus, as I mentioned earlier, for Best Beginnings, and this is some of the work that we do includes public announcements, PSAs, that you may have heard on radio or seen on television. And we send a radio PSA scripts all across the state, and stations virtually in every corner of the state are using them. I also wanted to mention some of the television PSAs. We have an in-kind contribution from APTI with KAKM in Anchorage, who has created, they're working now on their second set of television PSAs for us. And in this second set, we're focusing on how important early learning is for the business community. And I just want to say one of the people in the spots is Richard Strutz, who, you know, is the CEO of Wells Fargo Bank. And we also, through a collaboration with the Alaska Children's Trust, created a television spot that features Sven Hawkinson from Kodiak and his wife and darling children, and you may have seen that in the fall. It will be on again in February, and I think then another in April. So watch for that. And over the holidays, this year we did for the second time a collaborative effort with KTUU Channel 2, where there were other spots that focused more on reading. We also then had some video of some of the staff from Channel 2 who were reading children's books, and that was posted on their website and on ours. So with an effort to get the word out in a really palatable way to families and to others to ensure that all of us know how important the early years are. We also, you heard Cindy Curran talk about the early learning guidelines that have been published by the state and endorsed by the State Board of Education. And through a grant from the Alaska Children's Trust, Best Beginnings has created some new materials, and I have a set to leave with you here. Should have given them perhaps to Louis already, but it's I hope that you'll think that they're as beautiful as we do. We had committed to providing materials related to the early learning guidelines in languages other than English, and these are for parents, and there's a set for that has to do with activities for babies, for toddlers, and for preschoolers. And the first language that we worked on was Spanish. We currently are working, again, through a grant from the Alaska Children's Trust and some support from Education and Early Development to create a set like this in Yupik. And the language after that that we will work on is Tagalog. The Spanish booklets have been very well received in the community. And then the Department of Education and Early Development has asked us to produce the materials in English. As you can imagine, when we have these, you know, really lovely things in Spanish, and people would say, these are really great, but where's the English version? And so we're working with the department now to create that English version. Another of the activities that we're engaged in about literacy is Imagination Library, Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. And we're working with partners such as communities and schools, the Child Care Resource and Referral Network, the State Library, and have received some funding from the Rasmussen Foundation, from the Siri Foundation, from ConocoPhillips and BP to provide some resources in this area of Imagination Library. And there's a handout in your packet about that. It's a very low-cost way that books can get into the hands of children. We also are supporting other local initiatives, such as the ABC Read and Talk With Me Project in Anchorage and others. When we look at the second area of focus, learning away from home, we're bringing together, really, people and resources to talk about these issues, to ensure that every family who wants to have an away-from-home program for their children has one that is of high quality. And through a grant from the state, we developed a quality rating and improvement system for the state, which the Department of Health and Social Services has now and is trying to do a field test on that. We also are working to bring back to Alaska good ideas that have been tried out elsewhere and have found to be positive and productive. But we know that making sure that all children are successful means that we have to really make a pretty big cultural shift in our state. And so we're working to make that happen, and through the public engagement campaign that I talked about earlier, and also with bringing together the interested parties to make sure that we can get this work done together. And one of the things that Best Beginnings has been engaged in is really bringing together other members of the early childhood community so that we can talk about things, so that we can coordinate efforts and have greater collaboration. You might remember a year ago, the Governor's Summit on Early Learning that Best Beginnings supported, and that was held in Anchorage. We also have recently submitted a proposal to the Partnership for America's Economic Success to put on a business summit in the fall. And the entities that have signed on with us to co-sponsor it include North Rim Bank, Providence Hospital, and the State Chamber of Commerce. So we are at our last Early Learning Council meeting, one of our members said, well, just whether we get this grant of $10,000 or not, we need to do this business summit. And so I think that you'll be hearing more about that. And also at the Education Summit, Best Beginnings was very much involved with that, the summit that was held last fall, and the early childhood track of the summit. And it was really wonderful to see that early childhood was seen as part of the continuum of education and not sort of shuffed off to the side, but really was a part of the whole effort. When people ask, what will success look like? Well, we think that success, we'll know we're successful when everybody in Alaska feels that early learning, early childhood is vital to our state. And also that everybody understands that making those lasting investments, those investments really, really provide for lasting dividends. And that both public and private funds will be committed, that families will be engaged from the beginning in their children's education, and that programs will be accessible to everybody, and not cookie cutter programs, not a one size fits all, but making sure that, you know, we're smart Alaskans, and we can really make sure that we use creative solutions to problems and ensure that that families can get the kinds of support, family support, and choices that they want. As I mentioned before, with this collaborative work that we've been doing, a group of associations, and you'll see their names at the bottom of that slide, have come together and have talked about what our legislative priorities are for this year. And you'll see them here: Denali Kid Care, Child Care Assistance, Infant Learning Program, the Quality Rating System, Parents as Teachers, Head Start, the Pilot Preschool Program, and Best Beginnings. Now, I'm not going to talk about each of these things, and some of them are not really within, you know, this committee's purview. But I wanted you to know that this work is going on, and that we are together and wanting to talk to policymakers about these issues. And you'll be hearing shortly from Mark Lackey, who's here representing the Alaska Head Start Association. The pilot preschool program, which is in the governor's budget, is for $2 million, and I think is designed to serve about 500 four-year-olds through competitive grants to school districts. And Commissioner Ledoux has asked me to work with Cindy Curran and Paul Sugar in their department to pull together a group of people to figure out what that plan ought to look like. So I'm very much looking forward to that, and think that we'll be able to do something in our state that, again, isn't just a cookie-cutter kind of program. As we talk about the public-private partnership that Best Beginnings is, I wanted to just share with you briefly this notion of leveraging state and private dollars. Representative Munoz knows from the Alaska Humanities Forum how, and when Best Beginnings was housed there in our current relationship, that we go to the philanthropic world and say, can you help us? And they say, well, what's the state doing? We go to the state and we say, can you help us? And they say, and what's the private sector doing? So I just wanted to let you know that we really are looking for continuing this really quite fabulous relationship with the state, with some support from the state through the Department of Education and Early Development, and also with our private partners. So these are the kinds of things that we are looking for with Best Beginnings, for support from the state through that early childhood line that Cindy mentioned earlier. So for some support for the work that we're doing with Dolly Parton's Imagination Library, which is providing technical assistance to communities so that they can do this project, that they can make it sustainable in their own community, and to provide some matching resources. Also, we know that that people who live closest to where the work takes place often are the best decision makers, and so we're working to develop local partnerships around early childhood in communities. And then the public engagement campaign, which you all know about, which continues to be very high on our early learning council's list of priorities. And in your packet, too, is a listing of those priorities with much more information about each of them. But I wanted to share that with you as well. So in pulling all this together, it really is about, in the early childhood world, it really is about making connections. It's making connections among families, among programs, among providers, and among the general public to ensure that our very littlest children get what they need to be productive citizens in the future. And we're talking about a comprehensive system, not just isolated programs. And when I showed you the list of areas that all that our coalition really is interested in, we want people to look at that as part of a whole, not as sort of cutting out this little program or that program, but really looking at it as a whole. And I also am working with Commissioner Ledoux and Commissioner Hogan from Health and Social Services to figure out what the best governance entity for early childhood should be in our state. It's mentioned in the Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Plan, which our state has had in place for 2 years. It also is required by some federal legislation, which reauthorizes Head Start, and it's been in the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn recommendations. Bringing all the players together so that there is coordinated services, that the services are comprehensive, and that there is increased collaboration among all of us. We're not talking about creating additional government, but rather by bringing the public and private sector together, we can ensure that there's a better use of the resources that are available and that our children have the very best outcomes. So I very much appreciate your time and would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Abby. Are there questions? Representative Gardner?
Thank you, and thank you very much for the years of effort and probably a lifetime of experience that leads to the work you're doing now. And I have three questions that are, I think, relatively simple. On page 7 of this book, there's talk about in the Northwest Arctic, mm-hmm. what they call purposeful baby talk.
Yes.
And can you go into that just a little bit? I mean, I think in a sense all baby talk parents do with kids is purposeful, whether they were aware of it or not. But what's distinct about this?
From what I understand, and I did a presentation to the Economic Development Summit, actually, that was in Cotsby 2 years ago with Willie. I took him along to do it with me. But it's really paying close attention, and oftentimes it's with a special name for a baby that just that one person has. So as a grandmother, I might talk to my grandchild, calling that grandchild a certain special name that I would call him forever after. But that talk that's very much very, very much engaging the child, back and forth with the child, but it's the special relationship. And it's not something that is only within a certain population. It is, you're right, something that all of us do, but sometimes people forget, and especially young parents forget, that even very, very tiny babies are responsive to that kind of interaction.
Thank you. I have more, but I can...
No, you can.
Okay. These magazines that you showed us are also really wonderful. Are they distributed through public health department, pediatrician's offices? Are they provided free?
They are free because we used public and private grant funding for it. Barbara Brown, whom you may know, is working with us now on that project and on Imagination Library. And Barbara has fabulous contacts throughout the state. They are being provided through a whole variety of mechanisms. We produced a poster in English and Spanish about the availability, which has been all over. And she's just getting them out right and left. So they're going to a whole variety of places. They also are mentioned on our website so that people who might visit the website would see that as well.
Thank you. And I assume that's through OCS also, mm-hmm. offices. Okay, and then my last question, thank you, Madam Chair, is your legislative priorities, one of the items was parents as teachers. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yes. Do you know about the parents as teachers program, or are you
asking me for?
I don't know about
okay.
it.
Okay. This is a program that was developed in Missouri and is nationally recognized. It's evidence-based. It's a home visiting program in which well-trained visitors go into homes to work with parents of children from even before they're with the parent before the baby is born until school entry. And there are several programs around the state. They all are funded by grants, but that they have demonstrated success in better outcomes for children when they go to school. The national evaluation that I've seen also shows, I think, that it's that engagement of parents that follows children through the grades. And so kids who were being tested in the third grade who had experienced, I think, 2 years of parents as teachers were actually doing better than other children who had other kinds of early childhood programs. So what it said to me was that engagement of parents was what really made the difference. Programs are organized in a variety of ways. Sometimes it's once a week visiting. Sometimes it's every 2 weeks or every month. And then periodically, typically, there's a gathering of all the families together so that children have interaction with other kids.
Okay. One more.
Madam Chair, it reminds me of a program California used to have where young parents could go once a week to, like, it was kind of a community college, but it also was where pregnant teenagers were finishing their education, and they would take the babies of these young mothers, so the pregnant teenagers would bathe them and play with them and do stuff, and the mothers would talk in a group about sort of parenting issues. That program evolved and became a cooperative kind of preschool for the kids as they got older. And initially, when they were up until about 2 years old, the mother stayed with them. So it was a mother support group as well as preschool for the kids. And then as the kids got a little bit older, the mothers could choose whether to stay or not. And then it was a preschool with kids who had been together since infancy, assuming families didn't move. And it was part of community college system. It was really very wonderful.
Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. One of the things that people are talking about with the home visiting kind of program is that in many communities around our state, as you know, there aren't large enough numbers of children, young children, to bring together into a group program. And so doing something that helps support parents in their role as teacher of their child might be a way to make sure that those kids get early learning experiences as well.
And I would just... Thank you. Just to add one more thing is the benefit of doing it the way California did is that the parents are supporters to each other rather than somebody else supporting a parent and teaching that parent how to support the kid.
I will be happy to ask Melissa Pickle, who is the statewide coordinator for Parents as Teachers, to provide you with more information.
I can look into it, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Representative Book?
Thank you, Chairman. Director Hensley, let me echo my colleagues' acknowledgement of your efforts and your time. This is an issue, I think, that is just on the cusp of really being addressed, and your expertise, your knowledge, and your enthusiasm are going to help. You culminated your presentation with expectations, and I did go to that early learning seminar, if what you want to call it, in the fall of 07, spent 3 days there. I learned a great deal. One of the things I did learn was that our governor came. She made about a 20-minute speech. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard from her since. So we're over a year later, and I guess I need to know what these new commissioners have for a buy into this program, because without coordination statewide into all of the issues you brought up today, we're at an impasse where we're going to be going with this. So I'd like to find out where we've come from that point.
Madam Chair?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
We provided the recommendations from that summit to the governor last spring. And I think that
in looking at some of the proposals in the governor's budget, that there are several items there that were touched on during that summit. And when it's Denali Kid Care, with increases in child care reimbursement rates, and increase to Head Start, this pilot preschool program, I think those are indications that I hadn't seen previously, that there is it's greater interest on the governor's part. I can't speak for the governor, nor for the commissioners, really, but I do feel confident that both those commissioners are committed to ensuring that something happens. And when I talked about our communication about the statewide entity, this sort of governance entity, and how that might bring things together, that I think is a real step forward in ensuring that there is better collaboration, that there is formalized coordination of efforts. So I think that there's some movement there. And people are feeling positive about it. I would hope that as we talk more about the budget for next year, and that we're looking to see about increasing the early childhood line that Cindy mentioned by some $400,000 to help support the work that we're doing in these several items that I listed. I hope that would signal that there was more commitment as well.
Thank you, Representative Book.
Just final follow-up. The other major impact that had on me was to emphasize the lack of coordination of all of the private nonprofits, all of the other entities out there that are trying to do the same thing, and that we have many other entities out there with the same interest, and yet the state, through its many efforts, really doesn't have a means by which we can collectively go forward holistically in getting to where we want to be, I believe, in this state. So that was, kind of a clumsy, address to what I think and the direction that I'd like to see that we go is that there be more collaborative efforts in that regard. So I'm hoping that through the interest in looking at education as birth to death, mm-hmm. that we really evolve into this state as some means by which we can be a lot more successful in our endeavors. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Hensley, I agree that the governor has done a lot to expand early childhood in the budget, and certainly acknowledge those efforts as being very very real and very committed to the effort to increase opportunities for young people. So, Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Abby, I appreciate your presentation. And my question, I think, is along the same lines, and that's in terms of the availability of funding and just how cash-strapped some of these Head Start facilities are. And I know this from personal experience because my sister-in-law is the director of the Bristol Bay Native Association Head Start program. My wife was on the policy council, and our son participated in the program some years ago. And to hear the stories about how much ingenuity and how much effort it takes to stretch programmatic dollars, and how the struggle from each program cycle to year to year it is to keep the programs available in some of the outlying communities and whatnot, cutting back of personnel and whatnot, it's quite challenging. It's very challenging, and it certainly leads me to the conclusion that given the return on investment that early learning programs provide, and it's pretty clear that there's a strong correlation between the more program and services are provided, the more children benefit and throughout their lives and so forth. But not to put you in a position of having to make a political statement or what have you, but is that your observation as well, that and not just state government, but that more resources as a whole could be provided to some of these programs that are scattered throughout a very large and remote state.
Yes. and I know that while, and Mark will talk more about this, I know, while the early childhood community, I think, is grateful for the recognition that more resources need to go to Head Start and that there was an increase in the governor's budget, it was not what the association had requested. And so I know that all of us together will continue to advocate for increased resources. And as I had said earlier, you know, even our partners in the philanthropic world are being badly affected by the economic downturn, and we've had lots of conversations with partners who previously had contributed quite large dollars, and now they are having to cut back. So, so I think that we do have to do a better job of figuring out how to do the right thing with fewer dollars all around, but that won't stop any of us, I think, from continuing to advocate for this kind of investment over other kinds of investments.
Okay, one more question and then we must move on. Thank you very much. Representative Wilson?
You know, yeah, I'll wait till we do more with Head Start.
Okay, all right.
So that we can.
Abby, thank you so much for coming today. It was a wonderful presentation, and I'm sure we'll have other questions and opportunities to work on this issue in the future, so thank you. Let's see. Online, we have Laura Lee Peterson, an advocate for early childhood learning, and she is online to talk about the Child Care Connection Program. Laura Lee, are you with us?
I am having a real hard time hearing all of you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you very well. Why don't you go ahead and begin? We have approximately 10 to 15 minutes for the presentation.
Okay, I will be brief. I have not been able to hear a whole lot of Cynthia or Abby's presentation. So, again, I'm Laura Lee Peterson. I'm an early childhood advocate here in the Kenai Peninsula. I'm an early childhood program consultant and educator down here. I've been down here for 28 years. I'm speaking, though, for the Peninsula Early Childhood Organization. Their purpose is to assist with and provide for high-quality early learning experiences for all young children, to assist in funding training and advocacy and communication to inform and build public will. We're currently striving to ensure that parents and caregivers and early childhood teachers and programs have the knowledge and support that they need, and that every child is nurtured by informed, skilled, and caring adults. Currently, we are addressing the educational requirements for those working in licensed early childhood programs. Currently, the state requires that those working within the licensed programs receive 20 hours of training per year. Alaska is one of the few states left that has not implemented a higher degree of education in our field. And it's our understanding that in 2010 that will be looked at. And if Alaska follows what other states are already requiring, a CDA, which is a Child Development Associate degree, or an equivalent will be required, which is considerably more training than is currently required. And the training on the Kenai Peninsula is extremely limited. And, of course, with the low wages in the field, the cost of training is very difficult. So the group currently is striving to create a foundation so they can assist with more training opportunities here, to assist programs with improvements in development and with the early childhood career advancement. The early childhood programs are already struggling due to high cost of meeting all of the Alaska child care regulations, and are certainly going to need assistance with further developing training strategies to meet new regulations. So, and we are strongly in support of the new program, the pilot preschool program that's proposed. But our currently having to work on what is happening right now. And so I, because I didn't get to hear Cynthia and Abby, or very little of Cynthia and Abby, I'm not really sure what I missed there. But I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and if I can hear you, I would be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Laura Lee. Are there questions?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
I'm a little embarrassed at always going first, but
that's fine.
Put their hand up. I do have a question. You're talking about anticipating that Alaska will possibly in 2008.
Let me interrupt for just a minute. I'm so sorry. I can barely hear you.
Is this better? Can you hear me now? Okay. You mentioned anticipating that Alaska might be moving, I guess, next year into requiring a child development associate degree. Is that what the CDA is?
Correct.
And it seems to me that as we require more of care providers, not only do we run the risk of making it difficult and expensive for them to do it, and they may just quit providing child care, just move into another field. But the cost to parents would be increased, to families, and in an environment where there's already a shortage of quality child care, don't we, by tightening requirements, run the risk of just upsetting the system so much that families really cannot find care?
Definitely. It's kind of a catch-22, though. True, the turnover in the early childhood field is ridiculous, and that is a good part of it is because of the low wage. And what requirements already exist are very, very hard to meet because of the low wage. So, sure. Though every time our regulations are looked at here in the state, more is added, and education is bound to take place here any time. We are truly one of the last few states left that have an a higher degree of education to work with young children. So if it happens, it happens. I think that preparing for it is something that we need to take a look at.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Can you refresh our, for all of us, I think, who is required to meet these licensing requirements? I mean, if a parent leaves a child with a family member, they don't have to be licensed necessarily. If you leave your child with a neighbor informally, at what point does a child care provider have to be licensed?
When they are going to care for more than five children, they have to become a licensed provider. And depending on what number of they want to provide for, it's a different type of license, whether they're a home provider or a group home or a child care center, preschool, after school program. It depends on the numbers that you want to care for.
And just a brief follow-up. So if I had a set of sextuplets and asked my neighbor to watch them, that would be illegal on her part or on my part? Or
correct. That is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that if I remember last year, there was a movement to categorize child care centers so that parents would be able to know what kind of training the people in that child care setting had. Now, how far along is that? Are we doing that? Where is that at?
There's no separate categorization for the education happening in early childhood programs other than what exists inside of our current regulations. And they are all the same. All the way across the board, they are all the same. I mean, I'm not addressing anything in the Department of Education. I'm only addressing early childhood, licensed early childhood programs, birth to five. And currently, it's that simple. The state requires that everybody that works with young children in a licensed facility have 20 hours of formal training per year. However, it looks like it's going up, definitely. The CDA is the associate degree and or the equivalent to it actually has 120 hours, clock hours, of formal training attached to it. So if we take that jump, we're going to have a real struggle on our hands next year.
Laura Lee, Abby Hensley spoke briefly to that when she was presenting, and maybe it appears that you probably didn't hear that part of the discussion, but Abby discussed standards that were being looked at by the Best Beginnings Group. And Abby, if you'd like to come forward to answer the question, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. I think what Representative Wilson is referring to is the Quality Rating and Improvement System, the QRIS, that we've been talking with you all about, that was developed by Best Beginnings through a contract with Health and Social Services, and was presented to them in January of 2008. The department has received the report, the recommendations, what we wanted next, what we felt was needed next, was a field test of the system, and had requested that there be resources in the FY10 budget. It didn't come through. And so one of the things that we've been talking with the department about now is what can they do with no resources? What pieces might we be able to sort of pull out and say perhaps we can get funding for this part, or whether there's an interest on the part of the legislature in funding the field test. So that's where we are with it. We want to continue to have the conversation and keep that in people's minds, but currently there are no resources to begin the field test.
Thank you, Abby. Are there additional questions for Laura Lee Peterson? No. Laura Lee, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And next, we're going to have a discussion on the Head Start program. Mark Lackey, Executive Director of CCS Early Learning and Treasurer for the Alaska Head Start Association, is here today. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
Is this on? There we are. Good morning. My name is Mark Lackey. I am here representing the Alaska Head Start Association. And I am also I run one of the Head Start programs in our state. I am the executive director, as the chair mentioned, of CCS Early Learning. We're the grantee that provides Head Start services in the Mat-Su Valley and also in Chugiak and Eagle River. And so thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. I believe there's a very broad and large amount of information that you have in front of you. And so I just wanted to walk through some of those documents real quick. I won't have time to go through all of them in detail, but I wanted you to know what's available to you at a later date, or as we go through here, if you'd like to reference some of those things. So the first thing that I believe you have is a PowerPoint, and we'll walk through that. The next item, I think, in your packet is the What is Head Start document, just a one-pager. And it is basically a summary of many of these other documents that have more detail in them. The next document that I believe is there is the Alaska Head Start Association fact sheet. And that breaks down where we provide services, how many children are served, what grantees provide those services. It also has on there information about what we proposed for this upcoming year. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get to it. The next item in your packet is Why Head Start Matters. It's a three-page document. And it just has some statistics, some outcomes, and some measures there that we felt it was important to pass on and share with you about what Head Start does. The effects that we have in the state. Next item is called Alaska Head Start Association Critical Issues, and I plan to talk to you about this one. The next item is a position paper, that was written by the president of the Alaska Head Start Association. And that is actually hot off the presses. You're the first group to get to see it. And this is just the association's kind of statement and position on pre-K. Some things to think about from our perspective. And the last item that I provided for you is also hot off the presses. This is a report from ICER, and it talks about prevention of crime, what we can do to decrease the number of people that are incarcerated. And in this report, Head Start is mentioned as something that is it pays rewards. Investing early is something that can decrease those problems later down the road. So I will refer to some of those as we go through the presentation. I just wanted to make sure that I pointed out each of those and explained what they were to you. So I'm fortunate enough, these are all children that have attended our program, and they do so well at creating great pictures that help your presentations. And so I just wanted to help you to take a look as we go through some of these things. The first thing that I wanted to cover with you is, what exactly is Head Start? Head Start is a federal program that was started back in 1965. All grantees must meet and abide by federal performance standards. And I brought actually a mint condition copy of the Head Start performance standards with me, and I'd be glad to leave this with anybody that would like it so I don't have to pack it back home with me. But these are the kind of the rules and the regulations that govern our program. Each program is governed by a board of directors and also by a policy council. Board of directors is comprised of community members. Policy council is comprised of parents, or a majority of parents. All the services that we provide are provided at no cost to the families. There's a comprehensive focus on both the child and the family, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We're not just working with children, we're also working with that child's family. And health and developmental screens are required for all children that participate in the program. Just a quick breakdown of the money. Right now in our state, approximately $27 million comes into our state from the federal side of things, and about $7 million is contributed by the state of Alaska to Head Start at this time. The federal grants come directly to local grantees, and the feds require a non-federal share, which is 20% of our federal grants. And so that's where the money comes for Head Start services. Some more information on exactly what Head Start is. Monitoring and reporting is extensive. We always, you know, because we're a federal program, we like to just educate people on exactly what requirements there are in this area. There are over 5,000 regulations associated with Head Start contained here, and then also the broader regulations that apply to grants and fiscal reporting and those types of things when you are dealing with federal funds. There's an early alert system that's in place that works with individual programs to identify any problems or challenges that they have early and make improvement plans to address those problems or challenges that programs might have. Each program has a triennial on-site program review, and so teams of reviewers from across the country visit each Head Start grantee every 3 years. They come in and it's an exhaustive look at our program. They look at our program requirements, they go through child files, they make sure that we're reporting on our grants appropriately and properly. Very, very thorough review that happens every 3 years. Every year we have to report on the PIR, Program Information Report, and that's a bunch of statistics. It talks about how many health screenings were done, how many follow-up appointments were those children went to, what's the qualifications of our teachers, what's our attendance, our enrollment, those types of things, and that's reported annually. Every month we're required to report what our enrollment is. The federal government, rightly so, wants to know that we are enrolling the number of children that they're paying us to enroll, and the state. And that those children are attending as well. We don't want a slot reserved for a child if he's not attending, and so there's attendance requirements associated with all of our slots. Each grantee is required to create and to publish an annual report. There's a very specific list of things that need to be in those annual reports, where how much funding we receive, how it's used, results, those types of things. And so that's a requirement as well. And then programs are required to do an annual self-assessment, and that's something that my program is working on. Right now, we do this every year, and the way our program does it is we do our own federal review. We take the process that the feds will use when they come to visit our program, and we do it ourselves. And the hope there is that we identify any of our own challenges or areas that we need to improve and put those things into place. And that's exhaustive as well. That's an effort that's undertaken by our staff, by our parents, policy council, and also by our governing board members. Eligibility for Head Start services. The primary piece of eligibility is income. I have in your packet and on the slide the 2009 income guidelines. This is for the coming year. These were just released about a week or so ago. And so you can see that these income guidelines really target a population that doesn't have a lot of income. We find that this population typically tends to have children that are more at risk for whatever the reason. And so that's our primary eligibility guideline is income. In the Head Start performance standards, 90% of our enrolled children have to fall into these income guidelines. And so that 90%, when you talk about it's about 3,100 children that we serve across the state, 90% of those kids will be income eligible. We're allowed a 10% over income. And typically in my program, what happens is those children are eligible in some other fashion. Typically, it's because they have a diagnosed disability or special needs, and their families are also over income. And so that 10% allows us to serve those families. The Office of Head Start has just this past year allowed programs to serve families in the 100 to 130% of poverty level as well. And so there's a little bit additional, but you still need to serve under 100 before you reach out to that next 30%. These are the other priorities, criteria that make children eligible. Again, children with special needs or diagnosed disabilities, children that are homeless, foster children, children who will attend kindergarten the following year. So, you know, if they're a very young four, they're a young five would have priority over a young four. We want to make sure that we catch that child before he goes to school. And also returning Head Start children. So if we invest 1 year in a child, we want to continue that effort that next year before they go to school. How many children are served? There are 17 grantees that provide services in over 100 communities throughout our state. There are just over 3,100 Head Start slots that are available statewide right now. For the breakdown of that, again, you can refer to that fact sheet that had the columns in it, and you can see how many children are enrolled and how that's broken out by grantee. A very conservative estimate that the association put together is that there are about 7,700 children in our state that are eligible for Head Start or early Head Start, but are not receiving services right now. My own guess is that number is probably closer to 10,000. But each program reports on eligibility that they believe of the children in their area. And so that's our guess. Between 77 and my own guess would be 10,000 children that are currently eligible, but we are not able to serve. Services that we provide in Head Start, there's several different, I think, broad ranges. The first is educational services. And so when we talk education, we're talking a little bit different maybe than we typically think when we think K-12. These are very young children, and their attention spans are smaller. And our goal really is to prepare them for school. As that last, as a slide will show you here in a second, we want to make sure that we do whatever we can to make sure they're ready for school. We're building a foundation for success. And so we're working on pre-literacy and pre-math. We're working on social and emotional development, making sure that our kids know how to get along with others and know how to act appropriately in a group situation. We have violence prevention curriculums that we use in our programs, language development, creative arts, physical health and development, those types of things. And so in our education component, we address these different areas with the children that attend. There's in the three-page packet that says why Head Start matters, there are some statistics that talk about the gains that we see in literacy and math with our children. And so you're welcome to refer to that. I believe it's on page 2, and it addresses letter recognition and early math skills in the children that we serve. The next kind of area that Head Start focuses on, I think, is very important, and I think it's often overlooked in Head Start. But that's working with families. And we really want to educate and empower our families. We understand that we're going to have that child for a brief window of their life, but that family is going to have that child, you know, for 18 years or whatever it might be. And so our goal is to invest our time and our effort and our resources into that child and also into that family. So that child, again, has the support of that parent as they go through their school years. To do that, each family has home visits that are provided to them. So a teacher or another staff member, programs do it differently, will visit with that child. In our program, the goal is kind of once a month. We find families that need less than that, and we have families that need more than that. At these home visits, we work together with parents to set goals for the family, to set goals for the child, and then to offer our help in meeting those goals however we can. The goals are varied. Some families need help finding housing. Some families need help working on their GED or getting enrolled in a college program. Some families have more urgent situations. There might be a situation of domestic violence or those types of things. And so we work with those families however we can to provide assistance, provide resources or referrals to other entities in our community that might be able to help them. We also provide a further level of support, family advocacy. It's a more intensive way to help those families that need additional assistance beyond just those regular home visits that our staff provide. Another component of Head Start is the health, dental, mental health, and nutritional services. In Head Start, in the performance standards again, it is required that children be current on their immunizations, that they have a physical exam when they come into the program. That includes having their hearing and their vision checked out so that we know that those aren't hurdles in their lives, and if they are, we can address those. There's a dental exam that's required. We have consultants available to help us with any issues that are identified. And then we're required to follow up on any concerns that are discovered. If a child has that dental exam and the report comes back that they have cavities or whatever, we're required to follow up with that family. Have you gotten that taken care of? Have you resolved that issue? Same thing with nutrition, mental health issues. So we just follow up. We encourage those families, help them, support them however we can to make sure that those issues with their children are resolved. There's also statistics in that why Head Start matters around these areas. Mental health, and dental screenings, I believe, is in there. The goals of Head Start really are early intervention. I think the last item that I mentioned in your packet is that report from LICER that really talks about the success that we can have when we intervene early in children. It's really hard to talk about those things because we're not going to see that result for many years down the road. But we know, as Abby mentioned, that children are, they're in a critical window of development when they're very young. And so developing those patterns in their brains, developing that foundation for success, both in that child and in that family, is crucial. And so early intervention is the primary goal that we have here. Family involvement and empowerment, making sure that those families know, because again, we're just going to have them for a brief period of time, but making sure those families understand the power that they have as well. Having that foundation in place, making sure that we look at their social and emotional development, addressing any and all obstructions to learning, whether that's health or dental or social things, transportation. We provide transportation for children that need to get to school. In summary, we're just trying to get them ready for school. Whatever it is that we can do to prepare them for their school years, that really is our job. What is needed? This refers back to that Alaska Head Start Association critical issues page. It's a two-page paper, and this is the position that the Head Start Association has taken this year for what is needed in Head Start for us to be successful. During the past couple of years, we have really developed a stronger relationship with the Department of Education and Early Development. This past summer, DEED and the association worked together to come up with a plan on what we needed or what we thought we should do moving forward with Head Start. And so the association developed a plan. It's a two-year plan that addresses how we felt like our grantees could provide further services. It was a $2 million request for this first year. The request called for $1.8 million and new funding to serve approximately 200 more children. There also was an amount in there dedicated to preserving existing slots. A lot of our grantees, because of inflation, energy costs, challenges such as that, they really face challenges to keep the children that they have. And so we need to make sure we address those costs so that we don't add children in this area and lose children in this area. The request for a total of $2 million to help us meet that goal. The association, I think, is very excited that the governor has proposed an increase for Head Start. There's $800,000 proposal in her budget, and that will allow us to serve more children if that goes through. Not near the number that we think we should be serving or that we could serve. But it is a step in the right direction. Again, the association's position is that we can do more. We need to do more. You know, when you look at a number like 77 to 10,000 children that are eligible for services, these are small steps that we're taking, but we think they're very positive and necessary and needed. The second thing that is in that critical issues document is this idea of developing a comprehensive plan. The association is very much in favor of the pre-K program, parents as teachers. These are programs that are needed and necessary within our state. We cannot serve the entire population. We're targeted to serve, you know, this low-income population, these kids with disabilities and those types of things. There's a very wide range of need within our state. What we are encouraging and advocating that be put in place is a very coordinated system that requires different programs and services to work together. Written memorandums of agreement that address eligibility or enrollment. The last thing that we want to do is have different programs competing for children. We want these programs to work together to serve as many children as possible. And so the association really is taking that position that whatever programs are put in place, we just need to work together and know that we're all on the same page helping as many children and families as possible in our state. The third position here is that we need to dedicate workforce development funds. This is an area that is kind of a looming challenge for Head Start. It's a current challenge, but a looming challenge as well, and let me explain just a little bit more. The last time that Head Start was reauthorized, professional development mandates were put into place that required us to meet certain standards of professional development with our staff. If you look back in that Why Head Start Matters, I think it's on the last page, there's a chart that shows you the progress that we've made between, I think it's 2004 and 2007, and getting teachers' degrees and getting them more qualified. We've made huge progress in working on that, even with no increased funding, and even with the challenges that come with, you know, our staff having full-time jobs and families and making relatively low wages and those types of things, getting those degrees. That's just a huge barrier all in itself. Head Start was reauthorized again in December of 2007. In it, the bar has been raised once again. We aren't quite to the previous bar yet in Alaska, but now the bar has been raised again. In that critical issues document, it lays out what the degree requirements are for Head Start teachers. By September 30th, 2011, 100% of Head Start teachers must have an associate's degree in early childhood education. By 2013, 50% of Head Start teachers nationwide must have a bachelor's degree in early childhood or a bachelor's degree in coursework equivalent to a major in early childhood education. And so these are standards that we are going to do the very best we can to get to. As I mentioned, we didn't quite make it to the last bar, but now the bar has been raised on us again. These mandates so far have not come with increased funding. And in Alaska, we face increased challenges because of the geography in our state, access to education, and those types of things. This is just an area, funding is needed, collaboration and communication with the university system is needed. Whatever we can do, again, to help our staff meet these requirements that are in place. The last mandate that we made such good progress in, we were able to secure some federal funds that came through, that was in the SEED program, and that's what allowed us to get to where we are. So far, there are no funds to address this new mandate. And the last statement here that ASA has made is around Denali KidCare, increasing access to health care for the children and families that we work with. One issue that's not there, and I want to make sure I touch on as well, is capital investment. Our Head Start facilities are in desperate need of capital dollars. There have not been federal dollars for capital investment, and there has not been state dollars for capital investment. When I look at our facilities, many times I communicate with other directors, and Representative Edgman's sister-in-law is one of those, and she writes me emails in between dealing with flooding problems and those types of things. Challenges in facilities are huge, and if we're going to continue thinking about expanding and serving more children, we cannot do that without capital investment as well. School buses is another huge area of need for the association. The other resources that are available to you, I kind of went over those in your packet, and so that is available to you as well. Any questions that you have, I would be glad to answer those with the time remaining.
I just have a couple quick ones, and then I'll turn it over to the committee. The $800,000 increase in the governor's budget, would that result in increased federal monies as well? Is that kind of...
It would not.
It would not.
No, what the state has done currently is to provide additional supplemental funds, and so the hope would then to serve additional state-funded children with that money.
And then one other comment on the coordination, the idea to coordinate. I think that's an excellent idea, and recognizing that pre-literacy is so important to a student's later success. Issues that need to be identified early that are barriers to that success, I think it would be necessary to coordinate with the school districts and other providers as well. One issue that's come up here locally in my community is the fact that we're not providing kindergarten school buses. So, you know, if a single parent has a child that's school age, perhaps they can't get to school or get home at the end of the school day. So, you know, that's a real serious barrier to success and something that needs to be communicated, I think, from the advocacy groups to the school districts so that they can understand how important that connection is.
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, we're very encouraged. There's an interdepartmental group that's come together. You know, so many times it's getting those different departments to work together and talk about early childhood issues. And so that is in place now, and they've started meeting. And again, pulling the public private partners together, mm-hmm. I think, has made big steps forward in the
Great. Thank you. And we just have about 5 minutes. Are there questions? Representative Edgeman?
Just a real quick question. I need to leave here in a moment. But do you know how the $800,000 would be dispersed, the additional funding statewide?
Yes and no. On that fact sheet that we provided to you, you can see there's a bunch of bolded numbers in that column there. That's our proposed enrollment. And so the $2 million plan that we provided to the state was to serve approximately 195 new children, and those bolded numbers are where we identified programs that identified they could serve more children. Again, that's without capital investment. That's because we have a classroom available, or we close down here and we can reopen easily. Because it's not the full $2 million that we planned for, we'll have to scale that back as the $800,000 is provided, or if it is.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One is just a quick question. Is Head Start going to get any money from the stimulus funds?
Well, we hope so. There is language in both the House and the Senate versions that are there. We'll just have to wait and see. We don't know at this point if it's going to be to serve new children, if it's going to be, you know, if you're going to serve new children, it needs to be ongoing funding. It can't be serve children now and and not next year, or capital funds, what that is. But there is hope that there might be some federal funding there.
Okay, and follow up. The other question that I have is that we're really into this early childhood development because of proof that we now have on brain research and what we're finding out with all that synaptic activity and whatnot. But there's some newer brain research that just came out that is telling us that even if the kids have all the reading and mom reads to them and everything, like there's, it, you know, like so that they really have that synaptic activity happening, if there's domestic violence in the family, that shuts it off, and they can't get up into the other synaptic areas because there's so much activity in that first layer. Are we addressing that? I see where you have social and emotional development and then violence prevention. But this is pretty new, and so I heard about 4 hours of this, and it was so interesting. I mean, because it made a difference where you sat the kids in the classroom and all different kinds of things that schools could do and teachers could do, but you have to know to be able to do this. Are you getting any kind of training or anything like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, Head Start has such a long history. Since 1965, we've been kind of doing this stuff with early childhood. And, you know, I think we've realized throughout those years that it's such a comprehensive picture. You can't look at kids in a vacuum or children in a vacuum. You have to address all those issues that are in their life, you know, the violence issues, the nutrition issues, the family dynamics, whatever those problems or challenges might be. And so I think we've developed, you know, having these partnerships with families and developing these relationships, I think, has really helped us to address those concerns and remove as many challenges as possible. So those children are prepared for success.
Great. Thank you. We have time for one more question.
I have two.
Okay. Okay, two more.
Okay, one is quick.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. As we are beginning to require more education of teachers, associate degrees, and bachelor's, do we anticipate funding to pay them more because they're starting out without degrees and now we're requiring more training?
No. I guess the answer is we don't know. We haven't seen it yet. We don't see an increased funding to obtain those degrees. We don't see increased funding to pay the higher wages that will be demanded. Another concern that's out there is that as we work so hard to get these teachers further and further qualified, that then they'll be interested in higher paying jobs that they're now able to take.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other question is a little more complex. I have a lot of personal experience with Head Start. I have two older sisters who were bilingual Head Start teachers years ago. And back in those days, when I was 10 or 11 years old, I used to go with them in the summer times. I have one sister who, for a long time, was a family advocate and a social worker with Head Start. And as a former foster parent, I had family involvement with the programs. So I pay attention to what I read about Head Start, and I have seen some studies that show that by the time kids are in second grade, they really can't see a difference between the two. And I know that studies can, it all is in the questions and what you're looking at. Right. So that's part of the question, but I also noticed that on your Why Head Start Matters sheet, you say the following graphs are based on information taken from results of 11 Alaska grantees. So my question is partly about the statistics, but how were those 11 of our 17 grantees chosen? Would the charts look very different if all of our 17 schools or sites were included in those stats?
I think the only qualification, the only reason that all 17 aren't included is we didn't get reports from all 17. And so I think it's a representative sample. The programs that submitted their information and got it to us got compiled in this report.
Unless the ones who didn't get the reports in are the ones who are less organized and therefore less effective, and perhaps that would skew the results.
Correct. I truly believe that these are probably pretty representative of the gains that we're making. And you know, the studies that you talk about on your first question, I think it's very important that we always keep in mind that we're doing the best we can to raise the performance and the success ability of children that are maybe starting out with significant challenges in their life. And so those children have to be compared with their peers that also have those challenges that don't have access to services like Head Start. We can't compare those children to maybe children that have no challenges in their life. They're starting out up here, and we just want to move these children up as far as we can.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much for your presentation today. We've had presentations on the state regional boarding schools at Galena and Mount Edgecombe and early childhood programs, including the Child Care Connections, Best Beginnings, and Head Start. And I appreciate all of the good work and everybody that was here today. And thank you, committee, for good questions. And I believe we're ready to adjourn. So with that, I will adjourn. Thank you.